to be lost again. I went for walks. I went for walks. I went for walks, and on one of these, the last I took in Havasu, regained everything that seemed to be ebbing away. Most of my wandering in the desert I've done alone, not so much from choice as from necessity. I generally prefer to go into places where no one else wants to go. I find that in contemplating the natural world, my pleasure is greater if there are not too many others contemplating it with me at the same time. However, there are special hazards in traveling alone. Your chances of dying in case of sickness or accident are much improved, simply because there is no one around to go for help. Exploring a side canyon off Havasu Canyon one day, I was unable to resist the temptation to climb up out of it onto what corresponds in that region to the Tonto Bench. Late in the afternoon, I realized that I would not have enough time to get back to my camp before dark, unless I could find a much shorter route than the one by which I had come. I looked for a shortcut. Nearby was another little side canyon which appeared to lead down into Havasu Canyon. It was a steep, shadowy, extremely narrow defile, with the usual meandering course and overhanging walls. From where I stood, near its head, I could not tell if the route was feasible all the way down to the floor of the main canyon. I had no rope with me, only my walking stick. But I was hungry and thirsty, as always. I started down. For a while, everything went well. The floor of the little canyon began as a bed of dry sand, scattered with rocks. Farther down, a few boulders were wedged between the walls. I climbed over and under them. Then the canyon took on the slick rock character. Smooth, sheer, slippery sandstone, carved by erosion into a series of scoops and potholes which got bigger as I descended. In some of these basins there was a little water left over from the last flood, warm and fetid water, under an oily-looking scum, condensed by prolonged evaporation to a sort of broth, rich in dead and dying organisms. My canteen was empty, and I was very thirsty, but I felt that I could wait. I came to a lip on the canyon floor, which overhung by 12 feet the largest so far of these stagnant pools. On each side rose canyon walls, roughly perpendicular. There was no way to continue except by dropping into the pool. I hesitated. Beyond this point, there could hardly be any returning, yet the main canyon was still not visible below. Obviously, the only sensible thing to do was to turn back. I edged over the lip of stone and dropped feet first into the water. Deeper than I expected. The warm, thick fluid came up and closed over my head as my feet touched the muck at the bottom. I had to swim to the farther side. And here I found myself on the verge of another drop-off, with one more huge bowl of green soup below. This drop-off was about the same height as the one before, but not overhanging. It resembled a children's playground slide, concave and S-curved, only steeper, wider, with a vertical pitch in the middle. It did not lead directly into the water, but ended in a series of step-like ledges above the pool. Beyond the pool lay another edge, another drop-off into an unknown depth. Again I paused, and for a much longer time. But I no longer had the option of turning around and going back. I eased myself into the chute and let go of everything, except my faithful stick. I hit rock bottom hard, but without any physical injury. I swam the stinking pond dog-paddle style, pushing the heavy scum away from my face, and crawled out on the far side to see what my fate was going to be. Fatal. Death by starvation. Slow and tedious. For I was looking straight down an overhanging cliff to a rubble pile of broken rocks 80 feet below. After the first wave of utter panic had passed, I began to try to think. First of all, I was not going to die immediately, unless another flash flood came down the gorge. There was the pond of stagnant water on hand to save me from thirst, and a man can live, they say, for 30 days or more without food. My sun-bleached bones, dramatically sprawled at the bottom of the chasm, would provide the diversion of the picturesque for future wanderers, if any man ever came this way again. My second thought was to scream for help, although I knew very well there could be no other human being within miles. I even tried it, but the sound of that anxious shout, cut short in the dead air within the canyon walls, was so inhuman, so detached as it seemed from myself, that it terrified me, and I didn't attempt it again. I thought of tearing my clothes into strips and plaiting a rope. But what was I wearing? Boots, socks, a pair of old and ragged blue jeans, a flimsy t-shirt, an ancient and rotten sombrero of straw. Not a chance of weaving such a wardrobe into a rope 80 feet long, or even 20 feet long. How about a signal fire? There was nothing to burn but my clothes. Not a tree, not a shrub, not even a weed grew in this stony cul-de-sac. Even if I burned my clothing, the chances of the smoke being seen by some Wallapai Indian high on the south rim were very small. And if he did see the smoke, what then? He'd shrug his shoulders, sigh, and take another pull from his Tokay bottle. Furthermore, without clothes, the sun would soon bake me to death. There was only one thing I could do. I had a tiny notebook in my hip pocket and a stub of pencil. When these dried out, I could at least record my final thoughts. I would have plenty of time to write not only my epitaph, but my own elegy. But not yet. There were a few loose stones scattered about the edge of the pool. Taking the biggest first, I swam with it back to the foot of the slick rock chute and placed it there. One by one, I brought the others and made a shaky little pile about 2 feet high, leaning against the chute. Hopeless, of course, but there was nothing else to do. I stood on the top of the pile and stretched upward, straining my arms to their utmost limit and groped with fingers and fingernails for a hold on something firm. There was nothing. I crept back down. I began to cry. It was easy. All alone, I didn't have to be brave. Through the tears, I noticed my old walking stick lying nearby. I took it and stood it on the most solid stone in the pile, behind the two topmost stones. I took off my boots, tied them together, and hung them around my neck on my back. I got up on the little pile again and lifted one leg and set my big toe on the top of the stick. This could never work. Slowly and painfully, leaning as much of my weight as I could against the sandstone slide, I applied more and more pressure to the stick, pushing my body upward until I was again stretched out full length above it. Again I felt about for a fingerhold. There was none. The chute was smooth as polished marble. No, not quite that smooth. This was sandstone, soft and porous, not marble. And between it and my wet body and wet clothing, a certain friction was created. In addition, the stick had enabled me to reach a higher section of the S-curved chute, where the angle was more favorable. I discovered that I could move upward, inch by inch, through adhesion and with the help of the leveling tendency of the curve. I gave an extra little push with my big toe, the stones collapsed below, the stick clattered down, and crawled, rather like a snail or slug oozing slime, up over the rounded summit of the slide. The next obstacle, the overhanging spout 12 feet above a deep plunge pool, looked impossible. It was impossible. But with the blind faith of despair, I slogged into the water and swam underneath the drop-off, and floundered around for a while, scrabbling at the slippery rock until my nerves and tiring muscles convinced my numbed brain that this was not the way. I swam back to solid ground and lay down to rest and die in comfort. Far above, I could see the sky, an irregular strip of blue between the dark, hard-edged canyon walls that seemed to lean toward each other as they towered above me. Across that narrow opening, a small white cloud was passing, so lovely and precious and delicate and forever inaccessible, that it broke the heart and made me weep like a woman, like a child. In all my life I had never seen anything so beautiful. The walls that rose on either side of the drop-off were literally perpendicular. Eroded by weathering, however, and not by the corrasion of rushing flood water, they had a rough surface, chipped, broken, cracked. Where the walls joined the face of the overhang, they formed almost a square corner, with a number of minute crevices and inch-wide shelves on either side. It might, after all, be possible. What did I have to lose? When I had regained some measure of nerve and steadiness, I got up off my back and tried the wall beside the pond, clinging to the rock with bare toes and fingertips and inching my way crabwise toward the corner. The water-soaked heavy boots, dangling from my neck, swinging back and forth with my every movement, threw me off balance and I fell into the pool. I swam out to the bank, unslung the boots, and threw them up over the drop-off, out of sight. They'd be there if I ever needed them again. Once more I attached myself to the wall, tenderly, sensitively, like a limpet, and very slowly, very cautiously, worked my way into the corner. Here I was able to climb upward, a few centimeters at a time, by bracing myself against the opposite sides and finding sufficient niches for fingers and toes. As I neared the top and the overhang became noticeable, I prepared for a slip, planning to push myself away from the rock so as to fall into the center of the pool where the water was deepest. But it wasn't necessary. Somehow, with a skill and tenacity I could never have found in myself under ordinary circumstances, I managed to creep straight up that gloomy cliff and over the brink of the drop-off and into the flower of safety. My boots were floating under the surface of the little puddle above. As I poured the stinking water out of them and pulled them on and laced them up, I discovered myself bawling again for the third time in 3 hours, the hot, delicious tears of victory. And up above, the clouds replied. Thunder. I emerged from that treacherous little canyon at sundown with an enormous fire in the western sky and lightning overhead. Through sweet twilight and the sudden dazzling flare of lightning, I hiked back along the Tonto bench, bellowing the ode to joy. Long before I reached the place where I could descend safely to the main canyon and my camp, however, darkness set in. The clouds opened their bays and the rain poured down. I took shelter under a ledge in a shallow cave about 3 feet high, hardly room to sit up in. Others had been here before. The dusty floor of the little hole was littered with the droppings of birds, rats, jackrabbits, and coyotes. There were also a few long gray pieces of scat with a curious twist at one tip. Cougar? I didn't care. I had some matches with me, sealed in paraffin, the prudent explorer. I scraped together the handiest twigs and animal droppings, and built a little fire and waited for the rain to stop. It didn't stop. The rain came down for hours in alternate waves of storm and drizzle, and I very soon had burnt up all the fuel within reach. No matter. I stretched out in the coyote den, pillowed my head on my arm, and suffered through the long, long night, wet, cold, aching, hungry, wretched, dreaming claustrophobic nightmares. It was one of the happiest nights of my life. The Dead Man at Grandview Point. Somnolence, a heaviness in the air, a chill in the sunlight, an oppressive stillness in the atmosphere that hints of much but says nothing. The balanced rock and the pinnacles stand in petrified silence, waiting. The wildlife has withdrawn to the night, the flies and gnats have disappeared, a few birds sing, and the last of the flowers of summer, the globe mallow, have died. What is it that's haunting me? At times I hear voices up the road, familiar voices. I look, and no one is there. Even the tourists that creep in and creep out in their lumbering, dust-covered automobiles reveal a certain weariness with desert travel, a certain longing to be elsewhere, to be where it's high, cool, breezy, fresh, mountain or seashore. And they should. Why anyone with any sense would volunteer to spend August in the furnace of the desert is a mystery to me. They must be mad, these brave tourists, as I am mad. Each day begins clean and promising in the sweet, cool, clear green light of dawn. And then the sun appears, its hydrogen cauldrons brimming, so to speak, with plasmic fires, and the tyranny of its day begins. By noon the clouds are forming around the horizon, and in the afternoon, predictable as sunrise and sunset, they gather in massed formations, colliding in jags of lightning and thunderous artillery, and pile higher and higher toward the summit of the sky in vaporish mountains, dazzling under the sunlight. Afterward, perhaps comes a little rain, that is, a violent cloudburst above some random site in the desert, flooding arroyos and washes with torrents of mud, gravel, and water in equal parts, a dense mixture, the color of tomato soup or blood, which roars down the barren waterways to the river, leaving the land an hour later as dry as it was before. The clouds melt away, the thunder fades, and the sun breaks through again, blazing with redoubled intensity upon sand and rock and scattered, introverted shrub and tree. Rainy season in the canyon lands. These brief thundershowers are not entirely without effect. I can see these days a dull green fuzziness spreading like a mold across the distant swales of Saltwash Valley. Near at hand are a few of the plants responsible for that coloration. The tumbleweed or Russian thistle, hairy and prickly, unpleasant both to touch and eye. At the same time, the ground is being prepared for a more wholesome growth, the September resurgence of rabbit brush, sunflower, aster, wild buckwheat, and matchweed. With evening come elaborate sunsets in every named and unnamed hue of gold, purple, crimson, green, orange, and blue, spread out for 50 or 100 miles among the floating ranks of clouds, with spokes of light radiating across the sky all the way from the western to the eastern horizon. Often the sunset is reflected not only on the mountain peaks, standing like islands in a sea of twilight, but also on ranges of clouds to the east, where the changing colors can be seen, along with flashes of silent, sudden heat lightning, long after they have faded out completely in the west. This is the time, in these semi-humid August evenings after rain, when a few nighthawks will leave their daytime hiding places to climb and circle and dive through the air, feeding on high-flying insect life invisible from the ground. Of the genus Cordyales, related to the nightjar and the goatsucker, most birds have fantastic names, the nighthawks resemble in size and conformation the swallow rather than the hawk, while in their style of flight, constantly swooping and darting, they are also like bats. Now and then a nighthawk, high in the air, will fold wings and plunge earthward, the noise of the wind rushing through its feathers when the bird extends wings and pulls out of the dive is like a distant roar, a bovine bellow. And so among its many other names, the nighthawk Cordyales minor is also called a bull bat, at least in the southwest. They feed in the twilight, between evening and night, and again in that similar twilight, unknown to most Americans, between dawn and sunrise, at which times aerial insects are most abundant. In my sack on the cot out back of the trailer, I am awakened many a morning by the sound of their wild cries and thrilling plunges through the air. I open my eyes and see the summer constellations, pale, dim, oddly misplaced in the sky, the Big Dipper, for example, half sunk beyond the northern horizon. At first I think it is still night, but looking east I see a premonition of day and the greenish streaks of light spread out along the rim. False dawn? No, for I also see the nighthawks skating across the sky against the glow, a sure sign of the coming sunrise. Another kind of music sometimes fills the early hours. Almost every morning for a week I have been honored by the serenade of a den of coyotes, a family, perhaps, somewhere about a mile to the west of my camp. Weird, unearthly song, like the legendary wail of banshees, or more precisely like the sounds produced by new electronic instruments, such as the cithair and Andy Martin note. Occult music is but a part of the coyotes' repertoire. They vary the program with more conventional howls, yelps, and barks when it pleases them to do so. Usually they stop their singing and retire into the rocks out of caution soon after the sun comes up. I'm not going to look for their lair, for that might frighten them away. And we need coyotes, need them badly in Arches National Monument, as does the nation as a whole, for that matter. We need coyotes more than we need, let us say, more people, of whom we have already an extravagant surplus, or more domesticated dogs, which, in all fairness, could and should be ground up into hamburger and used as emergency coyote food, to raise their spirits and perhaps improve the tenor of their pre-dawn howling. This morning, I am requested via the shortwave radio to join a manhunt. Not for some suspected criminal or escaped convict, but for a lost tourist whose car was found abandoned 2 days ago in the vicinity of Grandview Point, about 50 miles by road from my station in the Arches. Grateful for the diversion, I throw canteens and rucksack into the government pickup and take off. I go west to the highway, south for 3 miles, and turn off on another dirt road leading southwest across Dead Horse Mesa toward the rendezvous. There I find the other members of the search party holding a consultation. Merlin Floyd from park headquarters, the county sheriff and one of his deputies, a relative of the missing man, and my brother Johnny, who is also working for the Park Service this summer. At the side of the road is a locked and empty automobile, first noted 2 days earlier. Most of the surface of this high mesa on which our man has disappeared is bare rock. There are few trails, and little sand or soft earth on which he might have left footprints. There are, however, many washes, giant potholes, basins, fissures, and canyons in which a man could lose himself, or a body be hidden, for days or years. There is also the abyss. A mile from where we stand is the mesa's edge, and a 1,200-foot drop straight down to what is called the White Rim Bench. From there the land falls away for another 1,500 feet or more to the Colorado River. If he went that way, there won't be much left worth looking for. You could put it all in a bushel sack. Learning from the relative, a nephew, that the missing man is about 60 years old, an amateur photographer who liked to walk and had never been in the Southwest before, we assume first of all that the object of the search is dead, and that the body will be found somewhere along the more than 20 miles of highly indented rim rock that winds northwest and northeast from Grandview Point. The assumption of death is made on the grounds that an airplane search by the sheriff failed to find any sign of the man, and that at least 2 days and possibly more spent in the desert in the heat of August with only what water, if any, he could carry is too much for a man of 60, unfamiliar with the terrain and the climate. We begin the search by dividing as evenly as we can the area to be investigated. Assigned the southernmost sector, my brother and I drive down the road another 5 miles to where it dead ends close to the farthest reach of the mesa, Grandview Point itself. Here we share our water supply and split up, Johnny hiking along the rim to the northwest and I taking the opposite way. All morning long, for the next 4 hours, I tramp along the rim looking for the lost tourist. Looking for his body, I should say. There seems little chance of finding him still alive. I look in the shade of every juniper and overhanging ledge, likely places to find a man besieged by thirst and sun. I look in the gullies and fissures, and in the enormous potholes drilled by wind and sand in the solid rock, holes like wells with perpendicular sides, man-traps. At times I step to the brink of the mesa and peer down through that awful, dizzying vacancy to the broken slabs piled along the foot of the wall, so far, so terribly far below. It is not impossible that our man might have stumbled off the edge in the dark, or even, spellbound by that fulfillment of nothingness, eased himself over deliberately in broad daylight, drawn into the void by the beauty and power of his own terror. Gaze not too long into the abyss, lest the abyss gaze into thee. I watch also for a gathering of vultures in the air, which would be a helpful clue. Not for him, of course, now perhaps beyond such cares, but for us, his hunters. The sun burns in a lovely, perfect sky. The day is very hot. I pause when necessary beneath pinyon pine or juniper for rest and shade and for a precious drink of water. Also, I will admit, for recreation. To admire the splendor of the landscape, the perfection of the silence. The shade is sweet and desirable, the heat very bad, and early in the afternoon, out of water, I give up and return to the truck. My brother is waiting for me, and by the lost expression on his face I understand at once that he has found our man. I radio the rest of the party. Johnny and I wait in the shade of the truck. They arrive. We all wait another hour until the undertaker, who is also county coroner, comes from Moab with his white ambulance, his aluminum stretcher, and his 7-foot-long black rubber bag. Then Johnny leads us to the body. The route is rough and long, across rocky gulches and sandstone terraces impassable to a motor vehicle. We walk it out. About a mile from the road we come to a ledge, rising toward the rim of the mesa. Near the top of the rise is a juniper, rooted in the rock and twisted toward the sky in the classic pose of its kind in the canyon country. Beneath the little tree, in the shade, is the dead man. Coming close, we see that he lies on his back, limbs extended rigidly from a body bloated like a balloon. A large stain discolors the crotch of his trousers. The smell of decay is rich and sickening. Although the buzzards for some reason have not discovered him, two other scavengers, ravens, rise heavily and awkwardly from the corpse as we approach. No canteen or water bag in sight. The nephew makes a positive identification. I can't imagine how. But the coroner undertaker nods, the sheriff is satisfied, and together with the deputy, the three of them begin the delicate, difficult task of easing the swollen cadaver into the unzippered rubber bag. Johnny and I retrace what we can of the dead man's course. There is no discernible trail on the slick rock, but by walking around his final resting place in a big half-circle, we cut sign, intersect his tracks, in a ravine 100 yards away. There on the sandy floor we find his footprints. Where he had entered the ravine, where he became panicky and retraced his way not once but twice, and where he had struggled up an alluvial bank to the ledge. From that point he could see the juniper with its promise of shade. Somehow he made his way to it, laid himself down, and never got up again. We return to where the others are waiting, gathered about the black bag on the stretcher, which the undertaker is in the act of zipping shut. The sheriff and the deputy are scrubbing their hands with sand. The undertaker wears rubber gloves. We are not far from Grandview Point, and the view from near the juniper is equally spectacular. The big jump-off is only a few steps south, and beyond that edge lies another world far away. Down below is the White Rim. Deeper still is the gorge of the Colorado. Off to the right is the defile of the Green River. Looking past Junction Butte, we can see the barren point where the two rivers join to begin the wild race through Cataract Canyon. Beyond the confluence lies the wilderness of the Needles Country, known to only a few cowboys and uranium prospectors. On the west side of the junction is another labyrinth of canyons, pinnacles, and fins of naked stone, known to even fewer, closer than anything else in the 48 United States, to being genuine terra incognita, the maze. Far beyond these hundreds of square miles of desiccated tableland rise the sheer walls of further great mesas comparable in size and elevation to the one we stand on. and beyond the mesas are the mountains, the Abajos and Elk Ridge, 40 miles south, the La Salles and Tuckanickavots, 40 miles east, the Henrys, 50 miles southwest. Except for the town of Moab, east of us, and the village of Hanksville, near the Henry Mountains, and a single occupied ranch on this side of the Abajo Mountains, the area which we overlook contains no permanent human habitation. From the point of view of political geography, we are standing on one of the frontiers of human culture. For the man inside the rubber sack, it was Land's End, the shore of the world. Looking out on this panorama of light, space, rock, and silence, I am inclined to congratulate the dead man on his choice of jumping-off place. He had good taste. He had good luck. I envy him the manner of his going. To die alone, on rock, under sun, at the brink of the unknown, like a wolf, like a great bird, seems to me very good fortune indeed. To die in the open, under the sky, far from the insolent interference of leech and priest, before this desert vastness opening like a window onto eternity, that surely was an overwhelming stroke of rare good luck. It would be unforgivably presumptuous to pretend to speak for the dead man on these matters. He may not have agreed with a word of it, not at all. On the other hand, except for those minutes of panic in the ravine when he realized that he was lost, it seems possible that in the end he yielded with good grace. We see him staggering through the fearful heat and glare, across the tilted ledge toward the juniper, the only tree in sight. We see him reach it at great cost, and there, on the brink of nothing and everything, he lies down in the shade to rest. He would not have suffered much after that. He may have died in his sleep, dreaming of the edge of things, of flight into space, of soaring. We are ready to go. A few flies are already circling above the dark shape on the stretcher. A few dark birds are floating on thermals far out over the chasm of the Colorado, somewhat below the level of the mesa. It is possible from here to gaze down on the backs of soaring birds. I would like to stay for a while and watch the birds, but the others are ready to go. The sun is very hot, the corpse is stinking, there is not enough shade for us all under the one small tree, and the world, the human world, is waiting for us, calling us back. For the time being. There are 8 men here alive, more or less alive. 4 pick up the stretcher and begin the march back to the road and the ambulance. The other 4 walk alongside to relieve when needed. We soon need relief, for the weight is greater than it looks, and the rock, sand, brush, and cactus make walking with a load difficult. The sun is pitiless, the smell is worse, and the flies are worst of all, buzzing in swarms around the putrid mass in the rubber sack. The dead man's nephew, excused from this duty, walks far ahead out of earshot. We are free as we go stumbling and sweating along, to say exactly what we please without fear of offending. Heavy son of a bitch. All blown up like he is, you'd think he'd float like a balloon. Let's just hope he don't explode. He won't. We let the gas out. What about lunch? Somebody asks. I'm hungry. Eat this. Why'd the bastard have to go so far from the road? There's something leaking out that zipper. Never mind, let's try to keep in step here, the sheriff says. God damn it, Floyd, you got big feet. Are we going in the right direction? I wonder if the old fart would walk part way if we let him out of that bag. He won't even say thank you for the ride. Well, I hope this learned him a lesson, God damn him. I guess he'll stay put after this. Thus we meditate upon the stranger's death. Since he was unknown to any of us, we joke about his fate, as is only natural and wholesome under the circumstances. If he'd meant anything to us, maybe we could mourn. If we had loved him, we would sing, dance, drink, build a stupendous bonfire, find women, make love. For under the shadow of death, what can be wiser than love, to make children, and celebrate his transfiguration from flesh to fantasy in a style proper and fitting, with fun for all at the funeral. But we knew thee not, old man. And there is, I suspect, another feeling alive in each of us as we lug these rotting guts across the desert. Satisfaction. Each man's death diminishes me? Not necessarily. Given this man's age, the inevitability and suitability of his death, and the essential nature of life on earth, there is in each of us the unspeakable conviction that we are well rid of him. His departure makes room for the living. Away with the old, in with the new. He is gone, we remain, others come. The plow of mortality drives through the stubble, turns over rocks and sod and weeds to cover the old, the worn out, the husks, shells, empty seed pods and sapless roots, clearing the field for the next crop. A ruthless, brutal process, but clean and beautiful. A part of our nature rebels against this truth and against that other part which would accept it. A second truth of equal weight contradicts the first, proclaiming through art, religion, philosophy, science, and even war, that human life, in some way not easily definable, is significant and unique and supreme beyond all the limits of reason and nature. And this second truth we can deny only at the cost of denying our humanity. We finally reached the road, which I had begun to fear we would never see. The death march seemed everlasting. And shove stretcher and burden into the undertaker's ambulance, a white Cadillac glittering with chrome and powdered with the red dust of Utah. He slams shut the doors, the undertaker does, shakes a few hands and drives off, followed by the nephew driving the dead man's car. The air is clean and sweet again. We can breathe. We rest for a while in the shade of the other cars, passing around water bags, smoking, talking a little. Someone tells a bad joke and the party breaks up. We all go back the 35 miles to the highway and from there by separate ways to our separate places, my brother south to Blanding, myself to the Arches. Evening now, a later day. How much later? I'm not quite sure. I can't say. I've been out here in the heart of light and silence for so long that the numbers on a calendar have lost their meaning for me. All that I can be certain of at this moment is that the sun is down, for there is Venus again, planet of beauty and joy, glowing bright and clear in the western sky, low on the horizon, brilliant and steady and serene. The season is late, late summer on the high desert. The thunderstorms have been less frequent lately. The tumbleweeds are taking on the reddish tinge of their maturity, and the various grasses, bluestem, fescue, Indian rice grass, gramma grass, which flourished after the summer rains, have ripened to a tawny brown. In the slanting light of morning and evening, the far-off fields in Salt Valley, where these grasses are most abundant, shine like golden velvet. The nighthawks, sparse in numbers earlier, have gone away completely. I haven't seen one for a week. But not all the birds have left me. Southwest, toward Grandview Point and the Maze, I can see V-shaped black wings in the lonely sky, soaring higher and higher against a yellow sunset. I think of the dead man under the juniper on the edge of the world, seeing him as the vulture would have seen him, far below and from a great distance. And I see myself through those cruel eyes. I feel myself sinking into the landscape, fixed in place like a stone, like a tree, a small motionless shape of vague outline, desert-colored, and with the wings of imagination look down at myself through the eyes of the bird, watching a human figure that becomes smaller, smaller in the receding landscape as the bird rises into the evening, a man at a table, near a twinkling campfire surrounded by a rolling wasteland of stone and dune and sandstone monuments, the wasteland surrounded by dark canyons and the course of rivers and mountain ranges on a vast plateau stretching across Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona. And beyond this plateau, more deserts and greater mountains, the Rockies in dusk, the Sierra Nevadas shining in their late afternoon, and farther yet, the darkened east, the gleaming Pacific, the curving margins of the great Earth itself. And beyond Earth, that ultimate world of sun and stars, whose bounds we cannot discover. Tukanikovats, the Island in the Desert. Late in August, the lure of the mountains becomes irresistible. Seared by the everlasting sunfire, I want to see running water again, embrace a pine tree, cut my initials in the bark of an aspen, get bit by a mosquito, see a mountain bluebird, find a big blue columbine, get lost in the firs, hike above timberline, sunbathe on snow, and eat some ice, climb the rocks and stand in the wind at the top of the world on the peak of Tukanikovats. On a Monday evening, before my 2 days off, I load bedroll, rucksack, climbing boots, and grub box into the pickup, and drive away, turning my back on the entrance station and house trailer and ramada, the lone juniper and all the hoodoo rocks. Take care of yourselves as best you can, I'm thinking. Your slave is off to the high country. Cousin Buzzard, keep an eye peeled for trouble. Over the rocky wagon road, that trail of dust and sand and washouts which I love, which the tourists hate so deeply, I go jouncing, banging, clattering in the old Chevy, scaring the daylights out of the lizards and beetles trying to cross the road. Stepping harder on the gas, I speed over the sand flats at 65 miles per hour, trailing a funnel of dust about 1.5 miles long. Washout ahead. Playing the brakes lightly, fishtailing over the sand ripples, I gear down into second, into low, and when I hit the new gulch, slam the brakes hard and shift into compound low, creeper gear, to negotiate the rocks and logs strewn over the roadway. 100 yards down the wash, I can see the culvert, displaced by the flood and half buried in quicksand. Ought to anchor that thing. Into low, into second, up to the surface of a long ledge of sandstone dotted here and there with stunted junipers and the iridescent silver-blue sage. From there in high, at highest feasible velocity, 30 miles per hour, through a slalom course of boulders, trees, and tight curves to the bank of Courthouse Wash, where a sliver of metallic-looking water snakes from pool to pool over the gravel, quicksand, and mud. On the shores of the wash are reeds and rushes, all bowed downstream under the weight of silt. In low gear, at full throttle, I gun the truck across the wash, anxious not to get bogged down, and roar up over the rocks and ruts on the far side. Easy enough. From here it's only 1 mile of dust, potholes, and dunes of blowsand to the paved highway, which I reach without difficulty. I look at my watch. I've driven the 8 miles from park entrance to highway in only 17 minutes, or at an average rate of nearly 30 miles an hour. Very good, considering the obstacles. Why the tourists complain so much about this road, I cannot understand. Every foot of it offers some kind of challenge to nerve and skill, and the drive as a whole is nothing less than a small adventure for man and machine. With brilliant scenery all the way, coming or going, what more could they want? Well, damn the lot of them, I think, rolling down the broad asphalt trail to Moab at a safe and sane 85. Not forgetting to keep one eye skinned for a sign of Frank Burkett, the local highway patrolman, whose favorite hiding place north of town was behind a Chamber of Commerce billboard welcoming tourists to Moab, Uranium Capital of the World. Was, until I leveled the billboard to the ground one night with a bucksaw, which I had borrowed for the job from the United States National Park Service Department of the Interior. Help keep America beautiful. Good thing Fred wasn't there at the time. His new Plymouth Interceptor would have got badly wrinkled, assuming he was asleep, as usual. Yes, I say, let them all squeeze to right, form single lane, remove sunglasses, turn on lights, reduce speed, obey signals, merging traffic ahead, as they supinely gas themselves dead. Passive non-resistance. tunneling into Hoboken, Manhattan, Jersey City, Brooklyn, New Haven, Boston, Baltimore, Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, Washington, Seattle, Chicago, Pittsburgh, L.A., San Diego, etc., Atlanta, Birmingham, Miami, etc., etc., Denver, Phoenix, Sacramento, Salt Lake, Tulsa, Oklahoma City, etc., 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 Houston, etc., and hell. But not here, please. Not at my own Arches Natural Monument National Park. I drive swiftly on, thinking the unthinkable, past Arches headquarters, where I glimpse the superintendent mowing his front lawn, and across the bridge over the Colorado River, rich and red as beet soup with a load of Moencopie mud flushed by yesterday's deluge out of Onion Creek Canyon. Poison water, selenium, arsenic, radon in solution. Into Moab and the bright lights, the jostling throng of kids, cowboys, miners, young bronzed hoods with sideburns and the sleeves removed from their shirts, through the blaring traffic and under the nervous neon, Atomic Cafe, to the liquor store. Just in time, they close at 7 here. A bottle of Liebfraumilch, and then to the market for meat, fruit, gasoline for my machine. Getting late. The sun is down beyond Back of the Rocks, beyond the escarpment of Dead Horse Point. A soft pink mist of light, the alpenglow, lies on the mountains above Timberline. I hurry on, south from Moab, off the highway, on the gravel road, past the new airport, past the turnoff to Old Roy's place, and up into the foothills. Getting dark. I switch on the lights and keep moving. I know exactly where I want to camp tonight, and will keep driving till I get there. Up to the top of Wilson's Mesa, and eastward and upward through the pygmy forest of juniper and pinon pine. Pale phantom deer leap across the road through the beams of my lights. A four-point buck and 1, 2, 3 does. Climbing steadily in second gear, I leave the pinon juniper zone and enter the scrub oak jungles, the manzanita, sumac, and dogbane. Higher still appear stands of jack pine and yellow pine, common though not abundant in the LaSalle Range. I turn off the main dirt road and take one narrower, rougher, with a high grass-grown center, drive through a meadow where the golden eyes of moor deer gleam in my headlights, and enter groves of quaking aspen, tall, straight, slim trees with bark as white as that of birches, easy to cut with a knife, much in favor among sheepherders, hunters, lovers. A bunch of cattle in the road. Too dull-witted to get out of the way, they trot along in front of the truck for a quarter of a mile before I can pass them. The road gets tougher, resembling a cobblestone alley, but here every cobble is loose and no two the same size or shape. When I come to a very steep pitch, the rear wheels spin, the motor stalls. I get out and load rocks into the back of the bed, adding weight and traction enough to climb the grade. In compound low, engine overheating, radiator at boiling point, I keep going, looking for a certain dim trail off to the right into the aspens. It comes. I turn off the road and drive through an opening in a derelict rail fence, brush beneath leafy boughs, and emerge in a small grassy glade surrounded on all sides but one by solid ranks of aspens. Here I stop, turn off the lights, let the motor idle for a minute, and then shut it off. After the droning mechanical grind of the long pull up the mountain, the silence of the forest seems startling, deafening, most welcome. I get out, stretch, relieve myself. The air is chill, and I put on a jacket. As my ears and nerves recover from the long oppression of the drive, I can hear the flutter of aspen leaves above my head and the ripple of running water not far away. In the light of the stars, I walk through tall, dewy grass, past a stone fireplace which I remember well, for I am the one who built it, to the edge of a brook. The water is gushing over roots, splashing among stones. It mills in a pool at my feet and races on into the darkness. On the surface of the pool I see fragmented stars, glints of light on the whirling water. Cupping my hands, I take a drink. Fresh from melting snowbanks on the peak above, the water is cold as ice. My hands tingle, burning with cold. I find some dry sticks, build a little fire in the fireplace, uncork the wine. Excellent. Waiting for the fire to settle down to exactly where I want it, I spread a tarp on the ground, close to the fire, and place my bedroll on it for a cushion, sitting like a tailor. I'll not unroll the sleeping bag until I'm ready to sleep. I want to save that desert warmth stored up inside it. The fire is right. I set a light grill over the flames, and on the grill roll out a big, thin, tough beefsteak, which happens to be the kind of beefsteak I prefer. I reach for the bottle. Very quietly and selfishly, all by my lonesome, I cook and drink and eat my supper, smoke a cigar for dessert, finish the wine. The stars look kindly down. Drunk as a Navajo, I pull off my boots and crawl into the snug, warm, down-filled, womb-like mummy bag. The night is cold, perhaps freezing. Should I drain the radiator? To hell with it. High on the lap of Tukanikovats, the king, wrapped in the sack in my home away from home, I close my eyes and go to sleep. In the sweet chill of the dawn, I wake up, hearing the ratchet-like screech of a squirrel. I open my eyes and see first a tall stem of grass bending over my face, weighed down by a drop of dew that glistens like a pearl on its tip. Beyond the grass, the pale trunks of the aspens stand in serried formation, thick as corn, blue-white and ghostly, their leafy crowns in perpetual motion. The trees are in shadow, but above the forest, shafts of sunlight fan out across the blue. Deep in the sky rises the bald peak of Tukanikovats, sunlit. Time to get up there. I wash my face in the icy stream, shocking myself wide awake. Make a fire, put water on to boil for tea, lay thick slices of bacon tenderly across the grill. While the bacon broils above the coals, I crack eggs in a skillet. 5 eggs. Add slices of green chili and scramble. Hunger stirs within me like a great music. Turning the bacon with a fork, I watch the light deepen on the mountain, am watched in turn by a blue jay, a red-headed woodpecker, the gray squirrel. In the bark of the nearest aspen, deeply inscribed, are the initials CEM, without a date. I squat close to the fire, lean half over it, inhaling aspen smoke, trying to keep warm, and eat my breakfast. After the meal, I pack fruit, nuts, cheese, and raisins into the rucksack, take my cherry wood stick, and start up the mountain. I follow the little stream, keeping close to its course up through the clear green shade of the aspens. Though resembling the birch, the quaking aspen, like the cottonwood, is a member of the willow family, and reveals its kinship by the delicate suspension of the leaves. Like that of the cottonwood, the foliage of the aspen responds to the slightest movement of air. Even a blow on the trunk with my stick makes the leafy assembly vibrate like bangles. In autumn, the leaves turn a bright, uniform yellow, glorifying entire mountainsides with bands and slashes of gold. I hear and see a few birds, woodpecker, flicker, blue jay, phainopepla, but no sign of any animal life except squirrel and deer. According to reputation, there are still a few mountain lions in the Sierra La Sal, ranging through from time to time, and possibly even bear, but it's not my kind of luck today to find their tracks. But if the animals are few, the flowers are plentiful, especially in the open glades and along the brook, where I find clusters of larkspur, blue flax, and seagull lilies. The larkspur is of the species called subalpine or barbie, Delphinium barbii, with a thick stem, deep blue petals, and a toxic content of delphinine. Too much larkspur and the flower-eating cow or sheep turns belly up, legs in the air, dead as a log, and crawling with maggots. Equally beautiful and not so potent is the blue flax with its pale sky-blue petals veined in violet, and the seagull lily or mariposa lily, state flower of Utah. Calochordis natalis, beautiful herb. Each deep cup-shaped bloom sparkles with morning dew. The seagull lily grows from an onion-like bulb, and if I were hungry or the flower more abundant, I'd dig one up and try the thing for flavor. Instead, I content myself with a stem of grass. Climbing higher, I enter by degrees into the Hudsonian life zone, leaving behind the Canadian with its aspen and Douglas fir, and find myself in the dark, cool depths of the silver fir and spruce forest. The shade grows darker, the silence deeper. Gracing the air is the subtle fragrance of sun-warmed, oozing resin. There is no trail, and the many dead and fallen trees make progress difficult. I leave the stream and work my way directly up the mountainside toward the light of timberline. As I ascend, the trees become smaller, and at the edge of the woods, on the margin of the scree that leads to the summit, the trees are little more than shrubs, gnarled, twisted, and storm-blasted, with mat-like tangles of Engelmann spruce growing over the rock. I stop to orient myself and to look for the best route to the top. I stand on broken rock, slabs of granite veined with feldspar and quartz, colored with patches of green and auburn lichens. I am on the north face of Takanikovats. Blocking the view to the east and northwest are Mounts Peel and Melanthin. But north and west and southwest, the world is open, and I can see the knobs and domes of the arches, the gray-blue Rhone cliffs beyond, the town and valley of Moab 7,000 feet below, the looming headlands of Hatch Point, Dead Horse Point, and Grandview Point, and farther away, farthest of all, wonderfully remote, the Orange Cliffs, Land's End, and the Maze, an exhilarating vastness, bathed in morning light, room enough for a lifetime of exploration. I look up to the peak. Timberline at this latitude is in the neighborhood of 11,000 feet. Therefore, I have about 2,000 vertical feet to climb. There is no trail to the summit, and from where I stand, no ridge of solid rock to make the climb easier. Nothing but the immense tailless slopes of loose, jumbled, broken slabs, a few islands of tundra, and up the middle, a long couloir partly filled with snow. I start toward that. Munching raisins, I climb and scramble over the rocks, which sometimes seesaw under my weight or start sliding, adding the hazards of surprise, twisted knee, sprained ankle, or crushed foot to the general interest of the ascent. Aside from the awkward footing, the climb is simple enough, requiring no special equipment except heart and legs. In the technical sense of the mountaineer, not a climb at all, but only a scramble.